It's the Blue of the Night online. Yours truly, Eamon Lenehan, relishing the opportunity to talk with someone who, like Gary Lineker and Shawadi Wadi, is from Leicester in England, Daryl Runswick. How's that for an introduction?
That's pretty good, thanks, Eamon.
Here's a more obvious one. You first met John Cage in 1984, how so?
Yes, I was singing with the group called Electric Phoenix. We were an avant-garde electronic classical music group, and we went to Zagreb. We were doing a concert there, which included a piece written by me, I Sing the Body Electric. And at the start of the concert, this rumour flew round the dressing rooms that Cage was in the audience. I have to tell you, Eamon, I've never wished for a peace of mind to go better than I did that day. And in fact, the piece did go quite well, but a disaster struck the concert as a whole, because our sound man, the sound man of Electric Phoenix, his name's John Whiting, and he doesn't mind my telling this story, he used to affect as his concert dress a kaftan. And this kaftan had enormously long flowing sleeves in the way that things did have in those days in the 70s and 80s. And he reached across his mixing desk to adjust a knob at the top of the desk, and his sleeve caught the master fader, and it shot to the top and feedback howled round the auditorium. Luckily, when he did it was between two pieces of music, so none of the music was ruined, but we slunk off at the end of the concert with our tails between our legs. Anyway, afterwards, John Cage was interviewed about the concert. So somebody said to him, which piece in the concert did you enjoy the most? And Cage replied, the feedback.
You did go on to work with him.
Absolutely, yes. Since he enjoyed the concert, we said, would he write a piece for Electric Phoenix? So he did. It's called Four Solos for Voice. And sorry to promote myself, but you can hear it on my website if you'd like to.
You're no stranger to RT Lyric FM, Daryl, are you?
No. In, I think it was the millennium year, 2000, I was asked to give a talk on extended vocal techniques, which is the kind of odd vocal sounds that Electric Phoenix used to make. And I wrote two 50-minute talks. They seemed to go down well, and I was asked back quite a few times. I must have come across to Limerick 12 or 15 times to broadcast.
This was on Art Zone and Horizons.
Yeah. Mostly Horizons, but I did a couple of things for Art Zone.
Now, for 10 years, you were head of music composition at the Trinity College of Music. How did that experience pan out for you?
It was great at first, because when I went to Trinity College of Music in London, the college was just being rescued from being a little bit moribund by Philip Jones, its new principal. And he hired me to rescue the composition department. When I arrived, there were two or three students only, and they were second studies. They were pianists who wanted to do a bit of composition. Mm. So I built it up, and 10 years later I left 30 to 40 students, all first studies, brand new recording studio. We'd moved to the Royal Naval College in Greenwich from central London, which was traumatic and wonderful both at once. But the thing about Trinity was the amount of administration became absolutely overwhelming. Mm. And by the end of my time there, I was miserable, because I was doing about 2 hours teaching a week, and the rest of the week was administration meetings. They'd call you for a meeting at 8:30 in the morning to discuss. Let's not go there.
No, let's not. You did resign then after, 10 years at Trinity College of Music as head of composition. Was the frustration one of the reasons?
Yes, the frustration caused me to overwork and caused me great stress, and I became ill. Mm. It wasn't just Trinity, all sorts of things. They say the three most stressful things in life are bereavement, divorce and moving house, and I'd done all of those very recently. And I was overworking and I just burnt out and went down with what they told me was ME, this thing where you're tired all the time. Mm. So it was a physical illness brought on by stress, I think.
And what happened after that then?
I had to resign from Trinity. I had to stop everything I was doing. I had a new partner at the time, and when I actually had, I had a physical collapse. I actually sat down in the street and couldn't go anywhere. That was near my partner Alison's, no, my wife Alison's cottage in Wales. She took me back there and we spent 3 months there, and I recuperated far enough that I could travel back to house in London, and then it was another 2 to 3 years before I was well again.
Right. How did you bounce back?
Trinity, they were very, very good to me because they had to pay me for 6 months after I got ill, but they looked after me wonderfully, and then they offered me a concert of my music as a thank you for my 10 years with them. And so that I actually, during my recovery, wrote a piece called Maybe I Can Have an Everlasting Love for that concert, and that got me on the road to recovery. Then it was my 60th birthday in 2006, and they put on a concert for me at the Almeida Theatre in London. More of my pieces played, and at that point I started to be on the up again, and so I devised a one-man show called Darryl Runswick in Droves. I played lots of instruments at once. I played guitars, bass guitars, keyboards, synthesizers, pianos. I sang. I had prepared backing tracks on a laptop, which I spun in. And so the idea was that although it was very serious music making, showing every aspect of my talent from my classical music to my jazz and pop, it was also something spectacular for the public to see, because I would start a synthesizer loop going, and then I'd lift my hands off the synthesizer and it would magically continue. Mm. And I'd move over to a guitar and start playing the guitar against the synth loop, and then the guitar would magically continue, and I'd go to a bass, and so complex textures would build up, and I'd be moving all over the stage, changing instruments and singing and telling anecdotes as well.
Sounds like a nightmare. Forget the thing, right?
I can tell you, logistically, yeah, it required enormous rehearsal. Rehearsing on your own is not quite so much fun as rehearsing with a group. I set up my front room in London as a kind of a stage area, and Alison would sit loyally in a chair listening to my rehearsals and making suggestions, and I would say all my anecdotes and jokes, and she would laugh dutifully at all the correct places. It was good from that point of view.
Did you record any of these concerts?
Yes, a few of them are recorded, and you can hear some of the results on my website.
Okay. Now, in 2009, you also wrote and performed a song cycle, didn't you, designed for your wife, Alison?
That's correct, yes. I'd been looking at the poetry of a Canadian poet called Elizabeth Smart. She was born in about 1912, I think, but by the 1970s, she was living in England and editing Queen magazine. But she chucked in her job at Queen and started writing poetry about the difficulties of being an old woman and an old woman writer, an old woman poet. Now, without being too rude
careful,
to my
yeah,
darling Alison,
yeah,
she's an elderly woman and she's a poet, so Elizabeth Smart's poems suit her very well. She can sing them, and they are extremely appropriate to her own position. So I wrote a song cycle called Smart Songs, and Alison and I performed them in London, and we've performed them in various places ever since.
Mm. This was you playing piano on the recording?
I'm playing piano on that, yes. Yes. It's just like a song recital, a classical song recital. Mm.
But for many years you were an accomplished bassist, playing with the London Sinfonietta. You did then stop for a while. I gather you're back playing bass again?
Yes. In 1983, when I was in my late 30s, I renounced the double bass, and I renounced jazz as anything that I wanted to do anymore. It was at the time that I joined Electric Phoenix, the vocal group, and I wanted to make my mark as a classical composer, so I discouraged any thought of me as a jazz musician or as a bass player. And it worked, and I ended up, as we've said, head of composition at Trinity College of Music in London, so that was pretty good. Mm. But when I got better from my illness in 2006, I suddenly thought, do you know, I love jazz and I'm going to start playing it again. And a few years later, Alison just said, I've known you all these years and I've never heard you play the double bass, which was what you were famous for in your youth. So I looked in the magazines and on Amazon, and I found an electronic double bass. It's a fingerboard. It's like an electric guitar, but you play it with a bow and you play it upright like a double bass. But it doesn't have the enormous wooden body that a double bass has. So for an old gent such as myself, it's much less problematic to lift and work with. So yes, I'm back playing the double bass, and I'm playing cello sonatas of all things. I'm playing Beethoven and Prokofiev and the Saint-Saëns' first cello concerto with Alison accompanying me on the piano.
Since 2005, you've lived, for part of the year at least, in the mountains outside Florence. How has that been working out for you?
Oh, it's wonderful, because you get away from everything. The phone doesn't ring. There is no phone. Well, we've got mobiles. It's a marvellous way of retreating from the world and getting some serious work done.
Yeah, how many months of the year would you spend there then?
5 to 6 every year. Oh, I mean, it's absolutely appalling.
I'm very jealous. Have you made connections with any Italian orchestras in that time?
Yes, there's an orchestra in the town of Bari in the south of Italy. They were doing some arrangements that I'd made of Benjamin Britten's cabaret songs and some of his early jazz-influenced instrumental music. And they wrote to tell me they were doing it. And as I was in Italy, Alison and I jumped in the car and drove down there. And I must say, they played them jolly well. And they made a terrible fuss of us. It was embarrassing. They took us out to meals and showed us their countryside. It was wonderful, and asked me to write a piece for their next season next year.
We're airing your music all this week on the programme. Would you mind just talking about some of the pieces, like Third Sonata?
Third Sonata was a piece I wrote when I was recovering from my ME. The main thing to say about it is that it's a piece where I ask a classical pianist to improvise. One thing that I hope I am famous for and will be famous for in the future is introducing classical musicians to the idea of improvising. And so in most of the movements of Third Sonata, the pianist improvises.
And who was the pianist on the recording?
The pianist is Alexander Schramm, who was a student of mine at Trinity when I was working there, but he's now making a big name for himself. He's Polish-English. I think his parents are both Polish, but he was born in Southampton.
Oh, it's a double CD, I see.
Yes, well, the Third Sonata is a long piece. I'm afraid it's an hour and a half long if you play the whole thing.
Yeah, and I have more than an hour's music he recorded as well. Some preludes by yourself?
Yes, that's the Scarfra Preludes. Scarfra is a funny word.
I
invented it for a system of making music that I invented. Scarfra is actually a contraction of the words scan, frame, advance, which is what happens on a television. A still picture is scanned onto a television screen, but it's only there for a 24th of a second, and then another picture is scanned in its place, and so on, 24 times each second. So the picture appears to be moving, but of course all the pictures are still pictures. And I introduced a musical technique when I play a passage of music and then I repeat it, but I miss off the beginning and add some more to the end. And then I play it again, and I miss a bit more off the beginning and add a bit more to the end. So the music repeats, but has changed all the time.
Right. Island, that song cycle?
Island was written for a friend who was a fine bass singer, and it's about an island off the coast of Wales. The poet is a woman called Miriam Scott, and she was gravely ill, and she went to this island on which there is a monastery for a period of recuperation. And when she got back, the island had made such an impression on her that she wrote a series of poems which I set to music with piano.
There's one here you did with Keith Tippett on two pianos.
That's right. I wrote that is an improvisation piece. Keith Tippett is, of course, best known as a jazz pianist and quite an avant-garde jazz pianist. He's also a composer of classical music of the highest quality. And the piece I wrote, it's called Set of Five. It's not actually for two pianos, it's for any group of improvisers.
Okay.
But I was asked to do a concert at the Dartington Summer School, the music school that happens every year at Dartington in England. And Keith was another of the people who was going to be at Dartington, and I thought, well, a two-piano version of Set of Five would work a treat. And we did it in the Great Hall. It was a late-night concert at midnight, and I got somebody to record it. And I said to Keith afterwards, can I issue this as a CD? And he said, oh, I'm a bit iffy about what I allow to be issued. Could you let me hear it? So I played it to him, and he came straight back and said, issue that, that's fine.
And how did it work? You were on two pianos facing into each other?
No, we were next to each other.
Okay.
So he was on the left, I was on the right, but the keyboards were in a straight line.
Yeah, and how can you improvise then without getting in each other's way, so to speak?
Ah, well, improvisation is like having a conversation. And sometimes you contradict each other, sometimes you agree with each other, sometimes you compliment each other, sometimes you hold back and let the other one talk, like you're doing for me so admirably at the moment, Eamon. And that's how it works. Improvising is like having a conversation.
Now we're going back a little bit further, I think. Moto Interrotto, have I pronounced that correctly?
You have,
oh,
yes.
I studied Latin.
It's an Italian phrase. Before I spoke Italian, I speak a little bad Italian now I've been spending my summers here. Moto Interrotto, it's a kind of a joke because there are a lot of pieces that written by composers called moto perpetuo, which means perpetual motion. And they're the kind of pieces that ripple on and on and on and on and on and never stop. But my piece, Moto Interrotto, means interrupted motion. So it's a piece with a lot of changes of style in it. I was asked to go to Warsaw in Poland and teach on a summer course there for musicians and composers. And one of the perks was that I got my own concert. And so I wrote this piece so that I'd have a world premiere to give them. And it's a piece for solo piano and electronic backing.
Finally, we're going way back now, 1991, mainlining.
And it's spelt curiously. It's M-A-I-N, which you'd expect, but I don't spell lining L-I-N-I-N-G. I put an E in the middle, L-I-N-E-I-N-G. What happens in this piece is that there's a tune that goes all the way through it that one or other of the four clarinets are playing, and the other three are working around it, accompanying, putting little ornaments in and things like that. I think that's why I called it mainlining.
Right. Now, you haven't mentioned the King Singers. I know you happen to do, what, over 100 arrangements for them. Do you want to talk about those briefly?
Yes. As a young man, I was at Cambridge University with the King Singers before they became the King Singers. They were King's College Cambridge choral scholars who formed this group.
When was this, Darrell? Late 1960s, was it?
Yes, it was. It was mid-1960s. Yeah. I'm sorry to say that I left Cambridge in 1967.
Right.
By 1970, they were working professionally, and I was both playing double bass on their recordings and doing arrangements for them. And the relationship carried on. I wrote them a piece as a gift for their 10th anniversary concert. I then wrote them a piece as a commission for their 20th anniversary concert. And a couple of years ago, in 2008, I performed on stage with them in their 40th anniversary concert.
Right.
So the relationship has been a long one. And they're now recording for Deutsche Grammophon for some reason. And they wanted me to do an arrangement for them and an oboe player. So I arranged a folk song, an Irish folk song, called She Moved Through the Fair for Oboe d'Amore and the King Singers.
And you got to do something for George Shearing with the King Singers, didn't you?
Yes, it's funny because when I was a schoolboy, when I was 12 or 13, I was playing trad jazz with a cornet player. And then this older boy called John Pickard came up and said, come on, play some modern jazz. And he was a pianist, I played the double bass, and he was transcribing George Shearing recordings from the 1950s, and we would play them more or less straight as if we were playing classical music. So Shearing was a hero of mine. When I did three arrangements for George Shearing and the King's Singers, can't remember, mid-90s, late 80s, he came to Abbey Road and I went to Abbey Road and met him, and it was a great experience.
I'm just doing some research here. 1991, it says, Get Happy.
Oh, right.
Working with George Shearing, did that present any special problems?
Well, no, of course, George was absolutely blind.
Yeah.
Somebody once said to him, have you been blind for the whole of your life? And he said, not yet.
Yeah.
Anyway, that meant that I just wrote the arrangements out. Somebody had to teach him the piano parts.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, when you are visually impaired, as he was, then you compensate by having your other senses enormously improved. So I think he learned things very, very quickly indeed.
You did mention Cambridge University there, the King's Singers and so on. President of the Cambridge Footlights, it would be a name that a lot of us here in Ireland would be familiar with from his TV work, indeed from his television criticism back in the Observer days. And you did write something, didn't you, with Clive James?
I did, yes. I wrote The Song of the Double Bass Player. We were preparing for the 1967 Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and Clive said, oh, come on, well, you've got to have a feature, Darryl. So he scribbled out 4 or 5 pages of lyric, and I looked at them and I thought, well, there's some good stuff here, there's some not so good stuff here, and it's all in the wrong order. So I kind of cut and pasted and turned it into what I thought was a better shape. And we tried it out at what they call a smoking concert, which is just a review in Cambridge. And it went down an absolute storm. And somebody happily recorded it, so you can still listen to it. Clive James was later heard to remark, when I gave Darryl this lyric, it was a good lyric. When he gave it me back, it was a work of genius.
Oh, very good. You'll take that, I'm sure.
I will take that, thank you.
While you were working with the London Sinfonietta, you also worked extensively with the Dankworths, Cleo Lane and John Dankworth.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I came down from Cambridge wanting to make my name as a jazz bass player. And indeed, within 18 months, I was working at Ronnie Scott's Club regularly. But the London Sinfonietta was also formed by people who I was at Cambridge with. They knew of me as a bass player, and one day they were caught short for somebody to come to Italy, curiously enough, to Siena, to perform the music of Luciano Berio. And so they called me up, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I want to be a jazzer, but I'll give it a go. And ultimately, I made a success of it. Berio was actually quite hard on me, because I hadn't played any contemporary classical music. Probably it was justified, but I was very hurt by it. I thought I was quite good. So, of course, what I did was I worked jolly hard, and by the time the concert came, I was playing like a demon. And so I went home after that, and I said to my first wife, Elaine, right, that's it. Can't stand this classical music playing. Please, if the phone goes, turn them down. And to her eternal credit, Elaine disobeyed me. I was out doing a session and I came back and she said, oh, the London Sinfonietta phoned up again. And I said, I hope you turned them down. And she said, no, I took the job. Mm. And the second job was a much happier affair, and I never looked back. I was, from that moment onwards, I was doing jazz, classical, and of course pop music on recording sessions as well.
For people who don't play double bass, can you explain the differences, the subtle differences then in playing jazz and classical music?
Well, the obvious difference is that jazz, you pluck the bass, and in classical music, you bow the bass. But the other thing is, of course, that in jazz, you play by ear, and in classical music, you're reading music. And in classical music, and this is something that is perhaps a little controversial, in classical music, you're expected to be in tune, whereas in jazz, it's slightly less important.
Okay. That clears that up anyway. Other jazz musicians you perform with?
I suppose the pinnacle of my career was when Ornette Coleman came to London to do some recording sessions. And his bass player, Charlie Hayden, had been arrested. They'd done a gig in Portugal, which was then a fascist dictatorship, and he'd given a freedom speech. So the police carted him off. Ornette Coleman arrived in London needing to do some recording sessions, and I was drafted in to deputise for Charlie Hayden. But I've also played for Phil Woods, I've played with Dizzy Gillespie. Of English players, I've played with Tubby Hayes and Ronnie Scott. And, of course, my great career move was to be chosen by John Dankworth to be his and Cleo Lane's accompanist for 12 years. And at the end of that 12 years, I was their pianist, not their bass player. Mm.
And you wrote a few things as well, didn't you?
Yes, I wrote a whole album for Cleo and some instrumentals for John as well.
Can you remember the name of the album?
Yes, it's called One More Day.
Okay.
It's not in print at the moment, but they've got them on Amazon at inflated prices.
Okay. Thanks for that top tip. Now, books. You've written a book yourself, haven't you?
I've written an arranging textbook. Yes, it's called Rock, Jazz and Pop Arranging. I wrote it in 1990 and it still makes me a few pennies every year in royalties.
Daryl, it's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much, Eamon. It's been lovely talking to you.
Maybe when I'm in England next time, if you're not in Italy, I might mosey around and have a chat with you in person.
Oh, that would be lovely. It'd be lovely to shake your hand.
Indeed. All the best to you, Daryl.